Hi, and welcome to today's webinar, Online Persuasion, Leveraging the Brain's Need for Novelty and Shortcuts. Today's webinar is sponsored by Conversion Conference and powered by Target Marketing. I'm Mike Green, Global VP of Content for ClickZ.com, SearchEngineWatch.com, and SES Conference and Expo, and I'll be the moderator for today's session. Just before we jump into the presentation, a few things to mention real quick. If you have any technical difficulties, you can troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console. That's the one you'll see marked with a question mark. Or you can let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions. There's a novelty. We'll be having a Q&A at the end of the presentation, but please feel free to submit your questions at any time. And please make sure that you do turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets, bells, and whistles on this console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console can do and how you can customize your experience today. Okay, on to the webinar today presented by Tim Ash. Tim is CEO of SiteTuners.com, a landing page optimization firm that offers conversion consulting, full-service guaranteed improvement tests, and software tools to improve conversion rates. He has worked with Google, Facebook, American Express, CBS, Sony Music, Universal Studios, Verizon Wireless, Texas Instruments, and many other leading companies. And Tim is also a columnist with ClickZ.com. So, for online persuasion, leveraging the brain's need for novelty and shortcuts, here's Tim Ash.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate that. I have to call Mike my boss since I write the column for the ClickZ website, and there's a new one out today, by the way, if anybody's on there and wants to check it out. Thank you all for joining this morning. I'm going to mess with your heads a little bit today. I mean that in a good way. I'm going to talk about the inside of our heads. Most of the time, we're looking outward and looking at technology and lots of other things. I'm going to do something a little bit different today. So as we go through, whether you like it or don't like it, please comment about it. I know we have some questions coming in through the Q&A window already. I think, Mike, somebody commented that you have a lovely accent, and I quote. Today, if you want to tweet about it, feel free to also tweet at Tim_Ash. CRO is conversion rate optimization, is kind of what we'll be talking about. And ConvCon is the hashtag for the conversion conference. Just a little bit about our perspective. I run an agency called SiteTuners, and we work with companies in a variety of different ways. So our perspective is from diagnosing landing page and website problems, developing landing page test plans, redesigning whole websites for better conversion, as well as training internal teams at companies to improve their conversion rates. But today I'm going to tell you a story. In fact, it's a five-part story. I'm going to start with, I'd say, a bit of a personal odyssey. And at each of these, after each one of these parts, I'm going to tell you kind of what I think is the key takeaway from my perspective, and hopefully you'll find it useful. Now, again, this is not the how to do things or the what to do. It's not whether to test your green button or your red button on your landing page. This is much more of the why to do it or how to approach it. Very much interested in your feedback. So, again, keep those questions coming. In the last 15 minutes, we plan to do an interactive Q&A. Well, let's start at the beginning. And the beginning for me was actually in Russia. That's where I was born, and hopefully they're having a little warmer weather than this picture suggests right now. But when I was born in Russia, I figured out right away that one of the important things you could do was tell stories. So I used to do a lot of storytelling. And as you can see, I started at a pretty young age. That's me on the left there, just in case you're wondering, with that very natty shorts and my little booties. I guess those are some summer camp mates of mine listening to one of my stories. And then I wrote and I expressed myself in different ways, and eventually I ended up in San Diego, California, at the University of California. And by the way, I would say this is the central library, the Geisel Library, named after Dr. Seuss, in San Diego at the University of California. I bet no one can say that that's not the best-looking library on a college campus you've ever seen. It's very cool. It's like a spaceship that sits up and is ready to fly away. But at UCSD, again, I tried to kind of engage in different activities. And I was studying computer engineering. At the same time, I was studying cognitive science. And UCSD was a very collaborative, interdisciplinary kind of place. And in my spare time, I found fencing pretty fun. So I was the Sabre team captain and All-Cals winner and conference champ. And you're thinking, what does this have to do with it? Well, what does this have to do with our webinar topic? I guess what my first realization was is that there are two types of brains that I needed to engage. You know, you've probably heard this about the left brain and the right brain and how they're different. I was using both. In the computer engineering side, I was using very much the left brain side of my head, the logic, the language, the science stuff. And at the same time, all of the creative stuff, the storytelling, the cognitive science and how the brain works, even activity like fencing, exercise the right brain parts about curiosity and learning and intuition and all of that kind of gut feeling stuff. And so my first takeaway for you guys is combining art and science is very important. We think of ourselves, I think, in online marketing as either one or the other. You could be like the Mad Men guys. I don't know if you've seen that series on AMC, the Madison Avenue advertising guys from the 60s, you know, where it's like, hey, babe, let's do a pitch and a three martini lunch. You know, and it's all about the concept and who's got this kind of the creativity and the cool stuff. Or you can think of yourself, maybe some of you think in the internet space there's really no place for that kind of creativity. Maybe you think of yourself as a very logical person. You're looking at your analytics. You're measuring the ROI on all of your campaigns. But what I'm here to tell you is you have to somehow unify those two things. You have to be comfortable with both the art and the science of it, the cold, hard logic and the measuring part, at the same time as you have to embrace creativity, intuition, different ideas, really diverse and radical thinking, and really, really not just thinking outside the box, but blowing up the box. So it's this constant tension, and it's important, really, to do both. Okay, let's move on to part two of my story, the tale of the three brains. Now, I just talked to you about the right brain and the left brain, but that's not what I'm talking about here. The three brains refer to the way that our minds kind of evolved. And there's been a lot of research, very exciting research, which I'll talk about towards the end, in neuroscience and especially about, you know, the brain's response to various kinds of social and marketing stimuli. But basically, the bottom line is it's like this iceberg. We think that we're kind of evolved, logical, reasoning beings, but I'm pretty sure that if I put you in a specific environment, a nice beach where you get to sit in your beach chair, or how about a bomb shelter in the middle of a war zone, I bet I could get you to act pretty much any way I want you to act. That we're not logical creatures. We're, you know, based on our circumstances, we'll do whatever we have to survive. Maybe thrive, but at least survive. So one of the things that the research tells us about the brain is that only 5% or so of our thinking, quote unquote, is conscious. That 95% of what we do is subconscious or preconscious is maybe a better way to say it, because they've shown that people will make a decision in their heads. And I mean, they've verified this by real-time imaging of the brain. And then a second or two later, they become consciously aware of it. That's right. We make decisions, but if you ask us why we made them, you know what we're going to do? We're going to rationalize. We're going to make up after the fact some kind of justification for a decision that our brain already made for us. And again, I keep talking about the one brain, but you have three brains. I know that sounds weird. You have the kind of logical brain or the neocortex. You also have the limbic system or the midbrain, and then you have the brainstem or your kind of reptilian brain. Here's a little more accurate, actually, picture of it and how it all fits together. So you have the big, you know, white matter or gray matter, you know, lumpy thing on top, and then you have your kind of limbic system in the middle, and then you have your stem brain, or brain stem, rather, down below. And, you know, each of these, you can think of it as when the brain evolved, each of these had survival values. So the reptilian brain only cares about survival, and it's very inflexible. In fact, it's downright dogmatic. If you put the same thing in front of it, it will do the same thing in response. If you put the same stimulus in front of it, it'll act the same way every time. It's just a knee-jerk reflex. It's the reflexive brain, okay? And it does things just to make us survive. It's also kind of important if you want to do things like keep your heart beating and your breathing going at night. That stuff happens automatically. I mean, you can moderate your heartbeat consciously and your breathing as well and modulate that, but the brain stem keeps it going and keeps you surviving the rest of the time. Now, this is pretty much present in all animals. The midbrains is kind of more of a recent evolution that all of us mammals got. Now, the midbrain or the limbic system has a lot to do with how we process emotional information. This is the, okay, you know, the reptilian brain is going to say, okay, I just touched the hot stove, I better pull my hand away. The emotional part of that is going to say, wow, I didn't really like that. So aversion or attraction, all of that stuff happens in this emotional midbrain. And not surprisingly, the midbrain is also where memories are formed, and they're very closely associated with sensory inputs of various kinds. Like I said, like touch, temperature, smell, taste, and sight, of course. And so all of these things kind of get combined across multiple senses. So one of the things, one of the key takeaways is if you want memories to be formed better, it's better if they happen in a multi-sensory way. If you can combine a strong emotion with a visual input or a smell or a taste. And I mean, some people like retailers and stores or casino operators have this down to a science, what kind of music to play, what kind of filtered air and scented perfumes to subtly pipe into the environment, because all of that will help us have that memory and that experience, the multisensory experience. And this is where, like I said, emotions happen and where memories are stored. And then we have what we think of as our brain, which is the neocortex, the new part. And it's not just any animal. It's not just mammals that have this. Basically, people have this in a really, really developed form. Other even close, you know, relatives of ours, evolutionarily speaking, don't have nearly the size of our neocortex or new brain. And that part has tripled in size in the last 100,000 years. So something's happening here on an evolutionary time scale. And what the neocortex helps us do is to plan, to delay gratification, to reason things out, to weigh things in a rational, analytical way. And, you know, but here's the big lie that I want to talk about, folks. And this is why the three brains are important. It's important to understand, yeah, which one's really in charge? And this is especially true of online marketing and everything we're doing on the web, which is really kind of first impression stuff and happens very quickly and is mostly novel to us. We're doing things for the first time in many cases online with visiting a new page. That's a new experience. When I click a link, I don't know what's going to happen. So all of the time we're basically going through these changes, and changes are processed by your reptilian brain. Here's how it basically works. First, we say our reptilian brain goes, is it dangerous? If it is, I got to deal with it because that has survival implications for me. Well, okay, if it's not dangerous, is it novel or interesting? Okay, if it is, then I'll explore it. But most of the time, the reptilian brain takes shortcuts. So it says, not dangerous, not novel or interesting, ignore it. And so it's kind of like this really, really strict gatekeeper. I think maybe a better metaphor would be a bouncer at the gates of the club. And it just doesn't let anything uncool come in. It's just not interested. It's used to ignoring things. Do you realize that they've done studies, there are apparently about 3,000 marketing stimuli a day that we're subjected to. Commercials, jingles, messages, badges that we see on cars or in clothing, whatever. There's 3,000 just advertising impressions on us every day. And there are hundreds of millions of various kinds of sensory impressions coming in every day as well. We can't possibly pay attention to all of that. We would go mad, literally. Some people do because they can't tune things out. And so the reptilian's brain's job is to just say, hey, does this matter for me to survive or thrive? And if it doesn't, then I'm going to ignore it. And so a lot of the things that you should be thinking about when you're doing online marketing is how to take advantage of these shortcuts. And to help you a little better understand the reptilian brain and its motivations, I'm going to tell you how it responds to stuff. Basically, the reptilian brain cares about the four Fs, okay? You probably heard a couple of these. All right, let's assume there's danger. Well, if there's danger, our first response should be run away, flee. We should run away from danger, right? Confronted with danger, run. And there are different kinds of danger. There, on the web, there's kind of insecure transactions. There's an unclear privacy policy. There are all these other things. There's a cheesy-looking website, you know, all of these things that undermine trust, and I'll talk about that a bit later. So we're just going to run from them. So don't kid yourself. When someone's confronted with, you know, kind of danger, many times we run away. The other alternative, the second F, is to fight. Now, obviously, that's not so appropriate in a physical setting, but, you know, one of the things that you should be thinking about in terms of your online experience is, you know, kind of is the tone of what you're saying, and is it coming across as threatening? Is it going to trigger people to just have this fight-or-flight response? The third thing that the reptilian brain cares about is feeding, the third F. And, I mean, I know that that sounds strange, but the way to think about it is, obviously, it doesn't apply online. There's no smell or rather, there's no taste, at least, online or anything like that. But these are the things the brain cares about. So even pictures of food and things like that will activate our reptilian brain. And finally, we're concerned with procreation. The fourth F is the F word. Hey, can I mate? Can I get some pleasure out of this? What's in it for me? Is this some kind of, you know, wonderful experience? Is it maybe the F word is a little too broad, but let's generalize that to a sensory satisfying experience. That's what we're looking for. Novelty in a good way. Hey, that's a great piece of music. Hey, that's a really pleasant visual scene. And they've shown that if we have like this bucolic scene with a forest with trees and yet enough open ground, kind of like a glade and a path, there's brook leading through it, that, regardless of our culture, is the physical environment we respond to. We get pleasure out of being in certain kinds of outdoor settings because we can see trouble coming, yet shelter is close by, and there's food and water available. All of these things kind of combine to make a visually pleasurable experience. And so, of course, I'm going to talk about images here in a bit, but the visual part is also one of those very important kind of sensory modalities that we should focus on. All right, so what's the takeaway of part two? Well, the takeaway is that the reptilian brain is really in charge. Don't kid yourself. If you think you make decisions logically, if you think the people visiting your website are going to read through all of the text you wrote and consider everything carefully, you are deluding yourself. If you think they're going to compare features and benefits and how many cup holders your car has, your Hyundai versus the Mercedes, they're buying the Mercedes because it's sexy, because their reptilian brain tells them it's hot. They're not buying it, the Hyundai, just because you tell them you have more cup holders. I'm sorry, it just doesn't work that way. So understand what motivates people and who's in charge. And it's the big bouncer, it's the reptilian brain. It's either going to ignore it, deal with it, or explore it. That's it. All right, well, of course, part of the brain leads me perfectly into part three, and I call this part the eyes have it. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, turns out that about half of your brain, total processing kind of volume or activity in your brain, is devoted to visual processing of one kind or another. I mean, like I said, we have the other senses. We have touch, temperature, smell, taste. But sight is really, really predominant. And sight is very, very important to our survival. And sight, again, took a very long time to evolve. It's very expensive hardware and software, if you will, to create the visual system. So I just want to take you back for a second to seventh grade biology. You probably heard this before. You have two types of visual systems in your brain, or sorry, in your eyes. The back of your retina is covered with rods and cones. You have three different types of cones, which are respond to different wavelengths of light, and you also have rods. Now, why are these things there? Well, they both have survival value, so you can't just have one or the other. And the rods give you the ability, sorry, the cones, to see fine detail. So hold your arm out at arm's length and hold out your thumb like you're hitchhiking. Look at your thumbnail. That little part, that the head of your thumb, is about as much visual field as you have for fine detail. So if you're staring at your thumb, everything else around it is unfocused. And it's very important to be able to discriminate that fine detail. I want to see if that berry I just ate is going to kill me or not. That has survival value, obviously, if it's edible. But at the same time, what's more important is things that change really fast in the environment. In other words, I can look at that berry very carefully and consider it, but now hold your arms out to the side, actually past 180 degrees, and try to wiggle your fingertips forward. And you'll see that you can see your fingertips off to the sides of your body. Go ahead and do it. Don't be embarrassed. Stretch your eyes, arms out to the side and wiggle your fingers forward. And in your peripheral vision, you'll see that wiggling, unless you have, you know, some kind of, you know, narrowing of your visual field or macular degeneration or something like that. But the point is, we need to know about stuff going on out there, especially motion. And that's what the rods are there to detect. And the rods help us to not be surprised. Because I can look at that berry all day long to determine if it's edible. But if that tiger's jumping out at me, I need to know that now, actually yesterday, if it's going to have survival value. So the way that we see is actually really weird. We think we're seeing this high-resolution version of the world. But this is kind of what we see. We see this gray, blurry thing, as rods don't detect color or frequencies at all. And then we move our eyeball around. And that happens in these involuntary eye movements called saccades. So basically our brain is jerking our eyeball around to look at points of visual interest. And as it does that, we get information about the world. And then we look and it fixates on another place for a second. And these saccades are happening all the time. And we're getting more and more information about the world. And as we uncover them, what we're actually is happening is that we think we see a high-resolution, perfect picture of the world. This is our experience. We think we see this sharp, crisp, full-color scene, when in fact we don't. Okay, that's our brain kind of filling in the blanks. And also the visual system has shortcuts as well to kind of make us perceive what's out there. And that's why we have optical illusions, because, again, the brain likes to take shortcuts. Optical shortcuts like, okay, there are two things next to each other that are different colors. That's probably the boundary between two objects. That's a good shortcut to take. But you take an amazing artist like Escher and you see all of his three-dimensional impossible things that he creates, he's just taking advantage of that, the visual shortcuts, to trick your brain into doing stuff that it really doesn't want to do. Again, shortcuts work most of the time, and most of the time is good enough. All right, so if we kind of take a look at the visual system and predicting this very important thing of how do we experience the world, well, when you think about it, when you look through a web browser, what is that? That's kind of like a little window onto the world. The brain doesn't know it's not a window. It's staring at a physical scene as far as it knows. And so there are three ways that you can get information about how we process these visual scenes or websites. And again, I know we have, you know, it's possible to probably put together some kind of joystick that gives you sensory feedback when you're flying a plane with your Xbox or whatever. And there are actually some experiments in having smell, special odor kind of, I don't know what you'd call them, odor sprayers that will help enhance your experience, but those are still in a relatively young form. Mostly we're experiencing the web through the visual sense. And there are three approaches to visual attention prediction. I want to talk about them briefly. Now, the first is eye tracking. Now, many of you are maybe familiar with eye tracking. It's, you know, the gold standard. You sit someone in front of a specially rigged monitor. You might have to put on special eye gear or something, or just record in stereo where their eyeballs are, and then you can see where they look on the screen and where they fixate. Remember those fascicods I was talking about? This little screenshot is showing you that. And the size of the orange balls is how long they fixated on a spot. And then the where they move to next is indicated by the number. So basically we're just, our brain automatically says what's interesting in the scene, and I'm going to construct the whole page out of that experience. But there are whole parts of the scene that we don't actually see or consciously experience. Now, eye tracking is the gold standard. It gives us very rich information, tells us where we looked, when we looked, how long we looked, and all of that. But it's kind of expensive, and you have to sit people down in front of a working page, and you also have to, prime them properly with a task. Where our attention goes is very much dependent on our intention. Let me give you two scenarios. Let's say you're on a product catalog page with a little grid of items, and I said, hey, find the biggest item. Okay, you'd probably just scan the page real quickly, and some would be obviously bigger than others, and you just click on the biggest one. But then I'd say, okay, find the cheapest item on the page, or I will kill you. Okay, I know it's a little extreme. By the way, I'm not a violent person, but you would spend a lot of time looking at every picture, dropping your eye down to the price below it, and go through very systematically, grid by grid, item by item, because your life depended on it. And my point is that you can easily imagine yourself doing those two tasks. Your intention very much controls where your attention goes. It's not as simple as saying eye tracking is some perfect thing or the gold standard. Where we look is very much biased by the way our kind of personality type we have, whether we're fast or slow paced and task or people oriented, and also by the specific intention that we have. All right, well, let's say you can't afford eye tracking, which probably puts you in the same camp as most of us. So one other alternative is mouse movement tracking. Here's a fun fact. People actually will move their mouse as a pointer. So if you want to see where people's conscious motions are, of course you have to move your muscles to do that. A lot of people, most of us will just leave our mouse alone if we're not using it, but some people use it as a guide or an aid. And so if you get enough people through your web page, you can kind of get this heat map of movement of their mouse, and you can see where people are lingering more or paying more attention. And this is available from software services like Crazy Egg, and ClickTail has some very sophisticated mouse movement tracking built into their software as well. So this is good, and it requires a live site and a lot of people to run through it, and then on average, you'll kind of see what people are paying attention to, if you will, on the page. And then one final approach is that you know that there's a lot of we know a lot about the visual system and attention processing in the brain already. So one thing you can do is use software to just predict it. You don't need people. With a fairly high degree of accuracy, we're talking about 75% correlated with eye tracking studies, you can actually predict or make a heat map, like you saw with the eye tracking or the mouse movement recording of the page, by just uploading an image. So this could be a live page or a mock-up. So we created this with our Attention Wizard software. Now, disclaimer, that's, again, our software. We made it. If you try it on our one-cent free trial, I'm going to make a penny off of you. So anyway, with all that aside, this is very good because it's not as accurate, but it allows you to get instant feedback. And it gets you feedback early on in the design of your page before it even goes live. So you can do this without recording mouse movement of real people. You want to make sure you get rid of all your attention leaks right away up front, okay? And as you can see here, these hotspots are going to focus on visually interesting things in the field of view, including people. There's going to be a lot of activation on human flesh, on faces, on high contrast, rarely occurring colors, so button color does matter. But also the relationship to everything else on the page and the context of it. So check it out. These are, you know, inexpensive things. Crazy Egg is pretty close to free. Attention Wizard is very inexpensive. So check out some of these tools to see how the visual system experiences your page. And as you can see, the killer app in this is actually visual stuff, sharing of visual information. You know, sites like Flickr and Shutterfly and lately Pinterest. Pinterest is exploding. What is it? It's nothing but sharing images, okay? And I just want to point this out by showing you kind of the evolution of Facebook and as they've begun to figure this out. And I don't know, this is probably a couple of years old, two or three. This is what your typical Facebook timeline looked like until a little while ago, okay? And then it became more visual. As you can see, now there are bigger pictures. There's a ribbon. Your little avatar picture in the upper left became bigger, and you can see it's evolving towards more visual stuff. Well, that's not enough. Here's what my timeline kind of looks like now. Now you have this giant banner graphic that you're allowed to use, and the pictures, you know, it's two-column format. The pictures are really big, so you can get the feel for them. They're not just tiny little thumbnails anymore. And so you can see this, how important this is, and people are starting to take advantage of it, and you should too. Now, one thing I will say about the visual system is it's very powerful, so you should use it for good or evil. Don't just use it to decorate your page. Then it becomes a liability. Anything you use, motion, like swipes of animated banners or tickers of some kind, anything like that, if that's not directly supporting your call to action, it shouldn't be on your page. So you have to be very disciplined and deliberate about your use of images, visuals, and especially any kind of motion, visual motion, because that's like dropping a hand grenade into the middle of the page and nothing else stands a chance. It's going to get wiped out. So think about what do you want to emphasize and why, and take advantage of what I just told you about the power of the visual system. All right, let's move on to one of my favorite topics, part four of my odyssey, and that is about trust and social monkey domination. Now, we've heard a lot about social media recently, and you know, it's kind of a wild and woolly world. But, you know, what's the premise? Why has social media really taken off? Well, I want to help you kind of decipher it, again, based on our human brain and the hardwired things that are happening. Social media landscape is pretty complicated. This slide is taken a while ago, kind of the ecosystem of social media companies. A lot of them have combined or gone out of business or what have you. But there's lots of ways to kind of, you know, from networking to creating content to gaming and all of these things, publishing information that you can do with social media. But what exactly is it? What does this whole big mess really mean? Well, I typed in social media guru into Google a little while ago and got 13 million results in 0.19 seconds, by the way. That's pretty fast. So what does that mean? Do we need new gurus to guide us through this social media thing? Is it like one of those old maps where you fall off the edge of the world or get eaten by the sea monsters in the uncharted lands? You know, what does it mean? Well, you know, I pulled up this social media tag cloud. What is going on around the world social media, around the word social media? And this is what I found. And look at these words. Okay, we have social media, feedback, audience, content, conversation, making, connectedness, communities, love, participation. You know, is anything in there really new? Folks, this is not new stuff. Social media works because it's based on old stuff. And I want to just kind of talk about that a little bit, about our social natures and about trust. Now, when I think about trust, I think about it as this kind of concentric ripple. We trust people that are close to us, to the middle of our hearts, and then as we go out, we get less and less trust. Now, these guys, for example, I would lay down in front of a train for. Those are my little monkeys on vacation. And I just, there's nothing in the world, literally, I wouldn't do for them. And then we have our, you know, friends. Now, we like to, you know, spend time with them. We like to have fun. But, you know, would you trust your friend's taste in movies? Not necessarily, right? But at the same time, we can leverage this use of friends in a social media context. For example, I was listening to Pandora, and they were using Facebook to personalize the page. This is the internet radio. So I'm listening to this, you know, tuned by Lenny Kravitz, and then in the lower left corner, it you know, pulls in a friend of mine from Facebook and says, hey, this person also likes Lenny Kravitz. Well, you think, well, big deal, right? But what does Pandora want me to do? What are their conversion actions or desired goals? Well, it turns out they want you to either vote thumbs down or thumbs up on that song track to help them improve their recommendation engine, or to actually buy it for $1.99. Well, both of those things are much more likely if I'm getting a warm and fuzzy, like, oh, my friends like this too. So you can harness that, and Facebook has been very, very good at doing that, among others. But then the concentric ripple keeps going out. Now, if you went to a football game, you're surrounded by fans of the opposing team. Do you really have a lot of trust in them? Like, they wouldn't throw a crushed beer can at the back of your head, perhaps? No, you really wouldn't extend that much trust to them or expect much of anything from them. Strangers get a whole nother level of trust from us. But still, even at the smallest trust levels, we make certain assumptions about trust. If someone walks through a door in front of us, we don't expect them to slam it in our face. We expect cars to stop at red lights and not run us over. We are extending trust to total strangers dozens and dozens of times a day. Okay, so how can you harness not just this individual friendship level, but more these mass numbers or large numbers? Well, about a year ago, I was interested in downloading the latest version of the Firefox browser, and I happened to go on there and a download statistics page. Okay, I'm a nerd, I admit it. And one of the things that struck me is this really, really good use of social proof or the behavior of my peers. They had this gigantic number, 543 million downloads, and this was about 6 weeks after it launched, of this new version. Wow, think about it. If I was thinking about downloading it, and 500 million people have downloaded already, and they're kind of my peers, they're like me, right? Why wouldn't I do it? It serves as a shortcut. There we go again with that word. The brain loves shortcuts. It serves as a shortcut to my own decision-making. And here I am, and I go through, and I'm looking at this interactive map, and they had this really cool map with orange dots lighting up somebody every time somebody downloaded this. And I was in Europe at the time, in Germany, and so Central Europe was awake, and all these lights are lighting up in Central Europe. It's like, and I'm thinking, wow, people around me right now, this very moment, people just like me are downloading this browser. And do you see the powerful double whammy of that? Lots of people just like me. Then I don't have to think. I can be the lemming and follow the other lemmings. You know, are you going to go into the empty restaurant or the one that's got a line out the front? Well, I don't have to make a decision. I can look for social cues. If lots of people are doing it, maybe I should too. It's almost like this automatic thing. So take advantage of that by demonstrating social proof. But what do we mean when they say we're social creatures? Well, actually, there's not that much difference between us and our closest cousins. If you look at this, you know, one of the things that apes are known for is just group behavior, grooming, and just living in social groups. We're not that different. I dare you to find a difference in this picture. But are there limits to our socialness? Well, perhaps if you're Oran Jeremy or Charlie Sheen, the answer is no. But for most of the rest of us, there's some really interesting findings from a guy named Robin Dunbar. He did some research, and one of the things he wanted to investigate was, remember the neocortex, that big new part of our brain? He wanted to kind of see was what that was related to. And he came up with this idea that the size of an animal's brain is related to the complexity of social interactions it has to manage. And it actually amazingly correlated across different species with what they actually found in terms of the size of social groups. And what he calculated for people was that there's this rule of 150. Actually, it's 148 and changed, but let's round up. At about 150, you can have cohesive social groups where you have a personal relationship with everyone. And we see this in military units called companies that are about that size. And in small Hutterite villages in Pennsylvania, they're kind of an Amish-like religious sect. Every time they get more than 150 people, they go and found a new colony. Aboriginal tribes that were untouched by civilization, Africa, same thing. The average size of an African tribe was 148. I mean, right on the dot. And then finally, this extends to the modern world, Gore, which makes Gore-Tex. I'm sure you've heard of it. When they build a factory, they put 150 parking spaces out front. And when people start parking on the grass, they know it's time to build a new factory. It's like this self-regulating way of having well-controlled, well-functioning units. So the rule of 150, that's how many personal relationships we can have with folks. Okay? And so keep that in mind. What we want to do is really control for that and to have a personal experience as much as possible. Okay. Now, when we talk about that, I want to just share a couple of things I stole from other people. So what do we value in social interactions? One of the things is I've been very influenced by the work of Dr. Robert Cialdini. It's spelled Cialdini, C-I-A-L-N-D-I-N-I. I'll get that later. I have his book cover later in the presentation. But he talks about these universal persuasion principles that work in almost every situation. So what do we value in social interactions? Well, one of the things we really value is consistency. I mean, I can contrast. If I said someone's confused or two-faced or mentally ill or acts, quote-unquote, randomly, is that a good thing? No, that's not a compliment. You know, we value someone who's a person of their word, who's rational, who's stable, who's honest, who we can count on. Because remember, we don't want change. We don't want that freaky, weird feeling. If somebody came up to us and we don't know if they're going to, you know, give us a hug or shank us with a hidden knife, you know, that would be kind of a random world to live in, and most of us wouldn't want to live there. You know, that kind of creates trauma and stress and uncertainty, and our reptilian brain would be freaking out. So we value consistency, and we value commitment. And this is what Dr. Cialdini says about commitment. Once we make a choice or take a stand, we encounter personal and interpersonal pressures to behave consistently with that commitment. Let me show you commitment. This, folks, is commitment. This is not, oh, I'm going to try or I'm going to do my best. This right here is full-on commitment. The Vikings conquered most of Europe and much of Asia at one point and put colonies in the New World. When they would go somewhere, they're fierce warriors, yes, but they also had this unwavering commitment to founding new colonies. Do you know how they did that? They would find a spot that they thought they were going to do well in, pick the optimum conditions, and then the next thing they would do is to burn their boats on the shore. Because we're going to make it here. We're going to make a stand here. And that consistency with their commitment that they made is really what powered them and made them successful. Now, they weren't always successful at colonizing. And you know, the first colonies the Vikings made in the New World and on the coast of Canada, they died after a couple of years. They had to send more people. But the point is, understand our social natures, the size of our social groups, what we look for in social interactions, and try to provide that in your online experience. Okay, I have a couple more things to share with you. Part five, here we are, wrapping up our story. Full circle. I want to talk to you just about, just kind of as a, again, a motivator to not focus on the technology. I made this little graphic myself. I know you're probably not very impressed, but for those of you that have deciphered it already, it means there's nothing new under the sun. Folks, it's all old stuff. Our brains haven't changed. On an evolutionary time scale, we are frozen in amber. We're not changing. So you can, you know, study the farthest reaches of the universe and try to find that, you know, missing subatomic particle. You can focus on the technology and how cool the latest internet stuff is. It's, you know, Twitter this and Pinterest that and cloud computing, and it's all very wonderful, but it doesn't change what goes on inside of our heads. And that stuff is fascinating. To me, that's the last frontier. So what I'm going to leave you with here is four or five reading assignments. These are books that I highly recommend. Again, this is all in your slide deck in case you're wondering. There are some couple of great summaries of the neuroscience research, especially as it applies to marketing. Susan Weinschenk, who is a speaker at the Conversion Conference and very much enjoy her presentations, wrote that her latest book is 100 Things Every Designer Needs to Know About People, and it's fantastic. Along similar lines, Roger Dooley, who's also keynoted at the last Conversion Conference we had in San Francisco, came out with this new book called Brainfluence, which really breaks down a lot of the science behind the brain, how we respond to marketing influences, visual stuff, pricing, all kinds of context effects and things that you'll be able to put to good use. And Martin Lindstrom's book, Biology, is very interesting at what we're able to tell by scanning in real time people's brains in response to specifically marketing stimuli. Now, I've heard this isn't literally correct, but one of the things he claims in the book is that strong brands like Apple actually activate the same parts of the brain as religious devotion. So if you've ever owned an Apple product and you're one of the Apple loyalists, you probably know what I'm talking about. Don't try to convince them to switch to an Android phone, I'll tell you that. And finally, again, Robert Cialdini's book, Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion, is pretty much the place to start if you want to understand how to persuade people online and use the soft stuff, the social influencing stuff. That's a great place to start. My own book just came out in the second edition. I co-wrote it with Rich Page and Maura Ginty. First one was very well received. I don't know if you have a copy, but the second one's got 100 pages of new stuff as well as reworking and new examples. Very solid book. I recommend this to you as a primer on landing page optimization. I do say so myself. It's pretty good. It's got a couple of years of my life in it. And final takeaway with regard to the neuroscience, remember, it's not what's out there that matters. It's what's in here. It's what's inside of your bony skull and other people's bony skulls. So as you can get all of these, again, in the deck. I just want to reach out to everyone with a special offer. Now, you can thank our director of marketing, Casey Murphy, for this, but because of a snafu on her end, she extended an extra deep discount. If you're interested in Conversion Conference and you want to drink from the fire hose, the next one's in Chicago at the end of June, and through Friday, you can save $600 off of the current rate. All you need to do is, when you sign up, enter the promo code CLICKZ514. Let's click Z514 through this Friday. I'm very easy to reach. We're going to open it up for Q&A now. There's some ways to get a hold of me, very accessible. Mike, back to you. I'm sure we have some questions stacking up.
We certainly do, Tim. Thank you very much. A lot of very interesting information in there. Certainly quite a lot about the human brain, and I'm seriously thinking about getting one. probably the first question that springs to mind, Tim, is, do you feel at all embarrassed about letting people know that you listen to Lenny Kravitz?
Well, as an English snob, I would expect you to be listening to Vivaldi or something, but no, I'm not. I'm actually pretty happy about it.
So, seriously, here's a question, something that I was thinking about as well, because you've talked a lot about, of course, the emotions that we go through and, all of this stuff that's happening inside your brain. But when I get to a website, when I start looking at a web page, is the mission for me to try and get a visitor to spend more time on a web page by becoming more involved, or should I be thinking the other way around and have them spend less time, or is there no correlation whatsoever?
Less time should be the general goal. Unless you have a content site and you literally want me to sit there and read pages and then you have an advertising model, which I know, of course, ClickZ and others do, the goal should be less time. It should be easy to process. We're going to form that first impression very quickly. Within a 20th of a second, we form that kind of, is it cheesy or professional first impression of the page. And the goal should be not to load up our kind of cognitive load and make us think about how the page is organized or what it means. It should be to give us simple choices, clear, simple choices, get us deeper into the site or closer to the goal, make us understand the map of the world and how that page is laid out with as little effort as possible. Steve Krug, who was another keynote at Conversion Conference, wrote the fantastic book, Don't Make Me Think. It's a perfect primer on web design and usability, and I think the title pretty much says it all. You don't want people to think. You want them to get in and out quickly.
So here's another thing that just kind of crossed my mind as well when you were talking about the whole social media aspect and getting people involved. I mean, I think we're all fully aware of the fact that people like to share things online, and before they make a purchase decision, they may be talking to each other and, getting tips and ideas. But interestingly, when we looked at that tag cloud that you had around social media, there was nothing in that tag cloud, no words that suggested anything about buying stuff or or e-commerce or that kind of thing. I thought that was really interesting.
I agree. I think social media, the primary purposes of it are to connect, to share, all the things in that tag cloud. So if you're trying to push out marketing messages, or if you're putting the hard sell on me and assuming I'm in the bottom of the funnel, you're really misusing social media. It should be about conversation, personal responses, and it's going to take you money and time to staff it to do that right. But that's it's unlocking its real power, is creating deeper relationships.
Yeah. And something else as well, just a little bit about the technology. A couple of people have been kind of touching on the subject of the mouse movement idea and the algorithms that are used there. Could you explain a little bit more about what it is that we can learn about the way that people use their mouse across the screen?
Well, we know, again, what they focus on the page. We know they look at lines in a certain orientation, closure of shapes, texture, color differences, flicker motion. We know a lot about kind of how the raw visual processing works. That's kind of the bottom-up stuff. But then we combine that with top-down stuff. We recognize objects. And we actually have a dedicated area near our midbrain, near the emotional processing center, for just recognizing human faces. So those are especially impactful, and it depends on whether you use them for good or evil on the page in terms of supporting your conversion goals, but be very careful about human faces.
Interesting. Now, there was something that somebody did mention about using images. Let me just find that question. One second. Yeah, can you successfully use visuals that are not of people and do not make your site look cheesy, says Andrew?
Well, yeah, absolutely. For example, we use the physical object metaphor on our website. So if you go to pages deeper on our site, we use things like a coffee cup or a tree or jumper cables or chess pieces. We're maintaining one consistent thing, which is physical objects. But, yeah, absolutely. But we put kind of one picture on the page, right next to the big fat orange call to action button, and that helps you actually see the button better in a way. So again, if you're consciously using pictures to support conversion goals, I'm all for it. And pictures of non-people are absolutely fine.
And let's just go back to tools. There are quite a few people that have talked about the kind of tools. You mentioned a few there. Somebody's actually asking, what about your thoughts on the future of tools measuring things such as sentiment analysis? Anything?
For social media, I think that sentiment analysis is very important, and you can't do it all manually, but it's sure nice to say if people are at a moment tell if they're swearing at you or unhappy at you and what percentage of people that is. So that stuff's still evolving. There are no clear kind of benchmarks for it, but I do find it directionally it's very useful. Most of the tools we're focusing on these days have to do with qualitative analysis of problems on your website, so diagnosed problems with your landing page, through usability testing, things like usertesting.com and these in-page web analytics like ClickTail and Crazy Egg. They don't give you answers. They just give you problems, and you should be looking for problems, and then what you test, of course, are ways to address those problems and fix them. So don't be afraid to use qualitative tools, I guess, is my bottom line.
So John is asking, what's the role of stories in persuasion?
Oh, stories, especially if you use them as video, are very important. Stories bypass. They're a way to sneak past the bouncer. The reptilian brain can't avoid a story. If I started giving you cold, hard facts, you would really tune out because the reptilian brain would be the gatekeeper to the neocortex and wouldn't let you process that stuff. But if I say, let me tell you a story, just saying those words, which is what I did at the beginning of this presentation, if you think back, completely bypasses that because now you're ready to receive that as almost kind of a vicarious secondhand experience. And they've shown that when somebody's telling a story, their brain patterns will eventually sync up with the recipient of the story. There's kind of a 1 or 2 second delay, but you're basically inducing your mental state in the other person. It's a way of implanting almost like a direct experience when you tell a story.
Interesting. Here's a really good question from Jay, who asks the simple thing, how do I make $1 million online?
Well, the easiest way to make $1 million online is to start with $2 million.
Strange enough, my father once said to me about the whole $1 million thing. He said, the easiest thing, it's very hard to ask somebody to give you $1 million, but if you ask 1 million people for $1, it makes the job a lot easier. So, maybe
The keys are, I think I'm a big fan in terms of business models of marketing automation, of automated stuff, of low-price subscription services, That seems to be the way that you can really scale things. But having said that, I'm running an agency, which is just about the hardest thing you can decide to do. We're doing the hard work. So don't ask me. If I was a millionaire, I would not be talking to you guys right now. Sorry, I'd be on the beach doing my Tai Chi.
But Jen had a very kind of interesting observation much earlier on in the presentation, saying that in the opening slides that you showed the logos of some of the companies that you've worked with, and seems to think that there's a certain kind of a sameness, she says, to them, a certain point. So she's asking, is there a kind of a point of standardization when you're optimizing? I mean, I guess that's kind of saying, is there one rule, you know, one size fits all kind of thing?
Well, there are definitely guidelines. You know, have a professional site, have clear calls to action, use very specific messaging, and along the lines of client logos, that's a way to build instant trust and credibility. That's one of the pillars of trust. As you know, Mike, I've done a whole half-day workshop for you guys on that. One of the pillars of trust is third-party credibility. If other people say you're good, if you say you're good, you're a windbag. If I put up our client list and it's some of the biggest companies on the planet, that does the talking for me. And it's instantly recognizable. Those logos have a lot of kind of face time and investment in branding. So they're very powerful. Putting a list of those companies spelled out with their names wouldn't be nearly as powerful as flashing those logos for a second. So use badges and seals of various kinds and logos and media mentions and mastheads of magazines and all of that.
And what about the change in the way that people consume the media these days, bearing in mind that we have to think about kind of the three screens, you know, that you'll be looking at your desktop, you'll be looking at a tablet, and also looking at, your smartphone. What are the most important things to consider when you think about the different ways that people are engaging with your website or with your content?
Well, I think that the hardest thing to do is to design for mobile, not just because of the different operating systems and standards and resolutions on there, but also because it's an exercise in editing, which is incredibly difficult. So on mobile, you have to think, what subset of what you do is important to me now in real time? It doesn't have to be your whole site experience. You should really, really radically strip down and simplify and make things obvious. And like I said, that's about the hardest user experience design task there is. So hats off to all the mobile designers out there. Think about what can you rip out and what can you simplify.
So I guess there's another question here as well, which I guess is fairly general, but it fits in there. In the period of time that you've been working in this part of the industry, you've obviously looked at a lot of websites and pulled a lot of data. Are there any kind of very obvious things that go wrong, mistakes that you see over and over again?
Sure. We did our seven deadly sins of landing page design. I can rattle them off. Lack of trust, we've already talked about. Too much text on the page, visual distractions. Not matching the visitor's intent. If they came from somewhere, they had some expectation set. Those are just, you know, some of the obvious ones, and too many choices. That's another common problem, overloading them with information.
And I guess probably just as we start to wind it up here now, we have these opportunities to, I mean, when I first came online, I was back in 1995, and text on a page was about the only thing you could do, and then eventually we could put a picture on there, put some kind of an image. I guess now with the technology, like I say, with people using different devices like tablets and that kind of thing, should we start and think more like, you know, TV producers and start and think more about audio?
Video is becoming increasingly accessible, both for short-form video and video spokespeople that walk onto the page. We're experimenting with that on several of our properties, and our clients have had some interesting, you know, very high impact things. I think more importantly is using data in real time to customize the experience. So marrying it up with the information in your customer database, also actually watching what I do on your site, and in response to what I'm doing, swap out content and show me a different experience. One-to-one personalization. We're talking about several 100% increase in conversion rates when you start using that kind of technology.
Wow. Incredible. Well, I think there are still some questions left, Tim. I'm going to forward those on to you, and hopefully you'll be able to answer those individually for the many people who are asking questions. Great job, and thank you very much.
No, my pleasure. So, thanks, Mike.
Okay, so it looks like we're just about run out of time now. On behalf of Conversion Conference and Target Marketing, I just want to say thank you to everybody for attending today. Please be aware of any upcoming webinars. And if you could just take a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your screen next, we'd be very grateful. Your feedback will influence the webinars we bring to you in the future and help us make them better as we go along. That's it for today. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your day.